Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's warm and sunny, and it must be New Orleans. Documents have this nutty way of coming out. Late, but still. U.S. government documents obtained through the Freedom of Information Act have recently been posted on the website of George Washington University's National Security Archive. They shed some additional light, don't you know? Light, that is to say, light on talks with the Taliban prior to 9/11, including with regard to what now appears to be repeated Taliban offers to hand over Osama bin Laden. What? One of the recently released State Department documents from March 2000 notes that a proposed, quote, gas pipeline from Turkmenistan through Afghanistan to Pakistan figured prominently in discussions about the mutual goal between the U.S. and regional players of stabilizing Afghanistan. Discussions on another proposed pipeline from Iran to India via Pakistan had also been proposed that were more advanced, and the Pakistanis had gone to Tehran to meet with Iranian officials to pursue these negotiations, but neither pipeline is likely to go forward in the midterm, the document concluded. A Pakistani official told the U.S. that Pakistan will always support the Taliban. This policy cannot change, he continued. But the Taliban were looking for a way out of the problem with bin Laden. The U.S. was urged to find a way to compromise with the Taliban, and possible ways that the U.S. and Taliban might use to break the impasse were suggested, including the possibility of a trial of bin Laden in a third Muslim country, or U.S. assurances that bin Laden would not face the death penalty, and a U.S. outline of what the Taliban would gain from extradition of bin Laden. All of this before 9/11. The U.S. had demanded in secret discussions with the Taliban that bin Laden be handed over for more than 3 years prior to 9/11. The talks continued until just days before the attacks. But if a compromise solution such as the above would offer the Taliban a face-saving way out of the impasse, it was never seriously considered. Huh. According to the BBC, the Taliban later even warned the U.S. that bin Laden was going to launch an attack on American soil. Oh, well. Former Taliban foreign minister Waqil Ahmad Mutawakil said the warnings were issued because of concerns that the U.S. would react by waging war against Afghanistan. Where's that crystal ball when you need it? His warnings had been ignored. A U.S. official did not deny such warnings were issued, but he said it was dismissed because, quote, we were hearing a lot of that kind of stuff, unquote. What kind of stuff? That the U.S. was going to be attacked by al-Qaeda? Yeah, apparently so. We'd been hearing a lot of that kind of stuff, ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen. The U.S. never produced the white paper it promised that it was going to present, containing the evidence against bin Laden in making the case for war. But the British government did present a paper that Tony Blair, I'm just turning the page here, said demonstrated bin Laden's guilt. Yet Downing Street acknowledged that the 21-page dossier did not amount to a prosecutable case against bin Laden in a court of law. Harder evidence, the document claimed, was too sensitive to release. To this day, the attacks of 9/11 are not listed as being among the crimes for which Osama bin Laden is wanted by the FBI because of the lack of prosecutable evidence. Documents, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, speaking of which, former President George W. Bush's advisors focused on toppling Saddam Hussein's regime as soon as he took office and discussed how to justify a war in Iraq shortly after invading Afghanistan, official documents showed this week, according to Agence France-Presse. That's right. Some cheesy surrender monkey journalists. A few hours after the 9/11 attacks, then Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld spoke of attacking Iraq as well as Osama bin Laden, according to notes of a meeting on that day, according to newly declassified papers. Rumsfeld told a Pentagon lawyer to go to his deputy to get support showing a supposed link between the Iraqi regime and bin Laden, according to the papers posted by the National Security Archive. In June and July of 2001, senior administration officials seized on intercepted aluminum tubes as proof Iraq was pursuing nuclear weapons, even before a preliminary assessment of the tubes, according to two State Department memos to then-Secretary of State Powell. One memo states the U.S. government's interest in, quote, publicizing the interdiction to our advantage and, quote, getting the right story out about the tubes, although they were soon found to have no nuclear connection. Confronting Iraq was also the focus of a July 2001 memo to the National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, Rumsfeld urging a high-level meeting on policy towards Baghdad. Forecasting an optimistic outcome for the war in Iraq, Rumsfeld said Washington's image in the region and the world would benefit from toppling Saddam. We would have a much improved position in the region and elsewhere, he wrote. A major success in Iraq would enhance U.S. credibility and influence throughout the region. Another document shows Rumsfeld discussing war plans for Iraq just 2 months after the invasion of Afghanistan. He tells Tommy Franks, then head of Central Command, to ready forces for the decapitation of the Iraqi regime. He lists in a talking point memo dated November 27, 2001, possible triggers the Bush administration could use to start the war, including Iraqi military action against the U.S.-protected enclave in Kurdistan, discovery of ties between Saddam and 9/11, or the anthrax attacks. Documents, ladies and gentlemen, never too late. And the new Iraq. This also from Agence France-Presse. We could call this the unsurge. Violence appears to have risen again across Iraq in recent months. July and August recorded two of the highest monthly death tolls since 2008, according to government figures. So that was a success. And now, ladies and gentlemen, part one of News of the Godly. We'll get to the familiar stuff in a moment. But first, there is the case of Bishop Long. Bishop Eddie Long in Atlanta, Georgia. I don't know if you saw his No Questions, Please press conference this morning. He does everything but deny the charges, which is good. It's a first step. But he's, you know, he said his lawyers advised him not to take questions, which is why he called a press conference. So forget the charges. Just some other... we can't know. You know, he's innocent until proven guilty, of course. So just some other actual facts about Bishop Eddie Long. He's often seen in a Bentley, this is according to the New York Times, he's often seen in a Bentley attended by bodyguards. He wears clothes that show off his muscular physique. He favors Gucci sunglasses, gold necklaces, diamond bracelets, and Rolex watches. He lives in a 5,000-square-foot house with five bedrooms, which he bought for $1,000,001 in 2005. His lavish display of wealth is in keeping with his theology. He tells his congregation God wants them to be wealthy, and asserts Jesus was not a poor man. His televised sermons reach 170 countries. From 1997 to 2000, according to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, he accepted $3 million in salary, housing, a car, and other perks from a charity he controlled. We're not just a church, we're an international corporation, he says. We're not just a bumbling bunch of preachers who can't talk and all we're doing is baptizing babies. I deal with the White House. I deal with Tony Blair. I pastor a multi-million-dollar congregation. After that article in Atlanta appeared, he hired a public relations firm and went on a campaign to improve his image. He began charitable programs to feed the poor, help struggling people with mortgages, and even offer haircuts to the homeless. I said, haircuts to the homeless. His background? Well, He studied business at North Carolina Central University, then went to work as a salesman for the Ford Motor Company, but was fired over inaccuracies in his expense accounts. Then he moved to Atlanta to study theology. When he took over the New Birth Missionary Church, it had only 300 members and a small building. He adopted a modern image, using slang and dressing like a hip-hop mogul. He adopted what has become known as muscular Christianity, a male-dominated view that emphasizes a warrior-like man who serves as the spiritual authority and protector in a family. His books on relationships suggest that men get in touch with their inner wild man. Women are to submit to their husbands. Bishop Long, ladies and gentlemen. Also, he has these special mentoring projects for teenage boys. But that's, look, all I can conclude is this, you know, we keep looking for reasons why America thinks of itself as an exceptional country, because we've had a civil war, we've had genocide, we've had slavery, we've had all the good stuff. Why are we exceptional? I think I've stumbled on it. Because we want our teachers to make less money than us, and our preachers to make more. Hello, welcome to the show.
Tell you a story every man ought to know. If you want a little loving, you gotta start real slow. She's gonna love you tonight now, if you just treat her right now. Oh, squeeze her real junk, gotta make her feel good. Tell her that you love her like you know you should. 'Cause if you don't treat her right, she won't love you tonight. If you practice my method just as hard as you can, you're gonna get a reputation as a loving man. And you'll be glad every night that you treated her right.
With a little bit of Ponderosa Stomp flavor, ladies and gentlemen, from the edge of Lake Pontchartrain, I'm Harry Shearer welcoming you to this edition of Le Show. And now, now it's going to get good. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I want to read the trades for you. And I think you'll want me to. From Current, the trade magazine of public broadcasting. See where I'm going with this already? Study sees growth if NPR sounds less elite. I'll read it for you. Please give. A new study for NPR identifies a much bigger potential news audience that would listen to public radio if the network works to break down perceptions that its programs are elitist and stuffy. Producers would have to make shows that are more lively and conversational. And promoters would have to take greater care when describing public radio as intelligent and serious. According to the Los Angeles-based firm Smith Geiger. They're not intelligent, they're not serious. Oh, please. That was just me making a stupid interstitial remark. The researchers found that barriers to entry for public radio listenership are rooted in what they called accessibility. Listeners' perceptions of the NPR brand, their ability to relate to the content, and the extent to which they find time to catch NPR news. When encountering public radio news, consumers from various demographic groups share a common problem. They feel excluded. It's really important that people hear themselves in the programming, says Margaret Lowe Smith, VP of Programming. We're talking about a private party versus a party where everyone's included. It's a party. Quoted in a presentation on the study is a Latino young adult user of new media. NPR, I feel, is mostly for educated adults from middle class and up. That's my impression. Some objections to the traits of NPR news are sure to prompt pushback from listeners and producers who value complexity and ambiguity, and don't mind lots of words. Wordiness is a problem for one white woman who spoke to researchers about NPR. I don't choose to listen to it, she says, because it's too much talking for me. Smith, the vice president of programming, believes there are ways to welcome more people to the audience without sacrificing quality. It's not about being not as smart or not as deep, she said. It's about telling stories with an ear that detects exclusion. NPR hosts do that now, she said, by quickly interrupting interviews with an identifying phrase when someone drops a name that would be unfamiliar to many people. Like, say, NPR. Except you can't. There is no phrase for that anymore because they say it doesn't stand for anything anymore. Remember that? But wait, back to the trades. Smith-Geiger projects that public radio's audience could more than double from its current size if they succeed in attracting news consumers and talk radio listeners who fit in three distinct audience segments: dutiful aggregators, team captains, and voracious voyagers. They're defined by their news and media habits, values, and lifestyles. This is psychographic. Don't let that scare you. Or actually do. Since these segments include a diverse ethnic mix of potential listeners, public radio has a good shot at attracting more minorities and younger adults, according to the director of NPR's Audience Insight and Research Group. Please give. Suitable, sizable minorities of these groups already listen occasionally to public radio news and might listen more often, but 70% of these prospective audience members are unfamiliar or only vaguely familiar with NPR. That was a pretty incredible finding for us, said the research director. These are news consumers who are not turning to NPR. This is the first time in 10 years that NPR has taken a detailed look at segments of its audience, said Smith. The last one was limited to just two cities that were then thought to be largely representative of the public radio system. It barely mentioned media usage on the internet. And yet, even so, the findings of this survey are roughly the same as those of the previous one. The study's findings on brand perceptions and the accessibility of NPR's content aren't surprises, according to Smith. The same issues came up in that last study, she said, but no one took on the job of planning how to address the problem. It wasn't owned, she said. For content accessibility, the summary proposes that NPR go for a more open, dynamic, and conversational tone in news delivery. There's an appetite for things that sound conversational and for people sounding like real people, said the research director. It also has to do with understanding what people like to know about celebrities. Oh, and what matters to them. Celebrities. The study also calls for greater emphasis on breaking news and frequently updated headlines, describing up-to-the-minute news as a cost of entry to news reporting. All three audience segments place a high priority on breaking news, says the research director. We need to consider what that means and how to do breaking news in a way that is appealing and consistent with our brand. Any move to add more breaking news can't undercut the in-depth coverage and editorial rigor that distinguish NPR, said Smith. And stay tuned for more, just as soon as I finished reading the trades for you, which I've just done. It's a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, ladies and gentlemen, on a related subject, there is a little matter of NPR Legal's refusal to allow underwriting announcements for my documentary film, The Big Uneasy, playing this week only in Los Angeles and New York. And as you may recall the story up to now, they had said that apparently there were legal reasons. The FCC regulations wouldn't allow them to say a documentary about why New Orleans flooded, which was the suggested language, you see. So this weekend, because the film is playing in L.A. and New York, local stations in those local public radio stations in those areas are allowing the language documentary about why New Orleans flooded. Yes, it's a puzzlement. The explanation comes from the NPR ombudsman in an email to the host of this broadcast, who says, well, maybe Washington, the national network, is just a little more fearful than the local stations. So it isn't about legal. It's about fear. So now we know what NPR stands for, National Petrified Radio. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. Oh, great. I just want to be a little more helpful here. Maybe what NPR needs to attract those voyagers and aggregators and all that is those two things that dangle down. That's right, fuzzy dice. Now, news from outside the bubble. And here's good news. Perv is back. For the last 2 years, he's earned a lucrative living on the global lecture circuit, enlightening select audiences on what it was like to have a ringside seat in the war on terror. But now Pervez Musharraf is returning from exile in Britain to be the savior of Pakistan, according to the Sunday Telegraph of London. He's about to put his theories to the test, quitting his comfortable retirement pad in London and returning to Pakistan to launch his own political party. The All Pakistan Muslim League will have its opening manifesto launch in London this week, aiming to change the political culture of his home nation. The public speaking firm to which Musharraf is signed also has Bono, Al Gore, and several other stars of the How to Save the World School of Motivational Speaking. I'm very comfortable traveling around the world on lectures, but I'm going into politics for the greater cause of Pakistan, Musharraf told the Sunday Telegraph in an interview. The people have reached the end of their hopes, and I want to try to rekindle their faith in both themselves and Pakistan itself. The former Special Forces soldier was also vocal on the military challenges in neighboring Afghanistan, saying that the escalating body count of British, U.S., and other NATO soldiers should be no excuse for an early pullout. U.S. plans to start drawing down troops by the middle of next year would be, according to Musharraf, the region becoming a nexus for terrorists all over the Muslim world. I'm not trying to portray a doomsday scenario unnecessarily, but the implications would be very serious for Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the rest of the world, he says. In a blunt comment on what he called the "bring the boys home" sentiment in Britain, he added that soldiers should not sign up for military service if they did not expect to face combat. But the educational benefits. From The Guardian in London, a computer worm which targets... You've heard about the Stuxnet worm, ladies and gentlemen? It targets industrial and factory systems. It's almost certainly the work of a national government agency, security experts tell The Guardian. But they warn it will be nearly impossible to identify the culprit. The worm has been described as one of the most refined pieces of malware ever discovered. It's been most active in Iran, says the security company Symantec, leading some experts to conjecture that the likely target of the virus is the controversial Bushehr nuclear power plant in Iran and that it was created by Israeli hackers. Security experts said to The Guardian that Stuxnet is a targeted attack on industrial locations in specific countries, the sophistication of which takes it above and beyond previous attacks of a similar nature. 60% of computers infected by Stuxnet are located in Iran, dramatically up from July. The senior international vice president of security at Lumentum says Stuxnet is the most refined piece of malware ever discovered and that the worm is significant because mischief or financial reward wasn't its purpose. It was aimed right at the heart of a critical infrastructure. Graham Cluley, senior consultant with the security company Sophos, I know it sounds like something else, it's not, warned against jumping to conclusions about the target of the attack, saying sensationalist headlines were a worry. He's wary of reports linking Stuxnet with Israel. It's very hard to prove 100% who created a piece of malware unless you're able to gather evidence from the computer they created it on or someone admits it. But he said its characteristics did not suggest a lone group. Stuxnet works by exploiting previously unknown security holes in Windows. That's right. Crucial infrastructure control systems, industrial and nuclear, run on Windows. The malware uses a stolen cryptographic key belonging to the Taiwanese semiconductor manufacturer to validate itself in high-security factory systems. More about Pakistan. The prime minister hailed a scientist convicted of attempting to kill American soldiers as the daughter of the nation and vowed to redouble efforts to secure her return to Pakistan. Thousands of protesters took to the streets after a New York court sentenced Afia Siddiqui, a U.S.-educated neuroscientist and mother of three, to 86 years in jail, and thereby ticking off the Pakistanis, our friends. She was alleged to have, and apparently convicted of, shooting. I don't know the details of the story, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm not going to go into them here, because I only have an hour. And finally, but there are weeks to come to get to that, weeks to come, finally, outside the bubble, Simon Cowell may be popular on television, but his life story is not so compelling. According to a survey of thousands of books found by staff at 452 Travelodge hotels after the guests had departed, his biography, Simon Cowell's, tops the list of the books most frequently left behind in hotel rooms. Simon Cowell, the unauthorized biography, turned up most. Sick Transit Television. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
And our schemes came true. Someday on the Ganges, I'll meet you once more, and I'll kiss you and caress you where the waters kiss the silent shore.
You just tell him to F himself with a barbed hockey stick.
Hello, sir.
Rom?
What's up? Where's the spark? Oh. We agreed the key in this part of the election cycle was to not lose the spark. Mm-hmm. I see zero spark.
Yeah, I know. Pod a spark.
Well, all due respect, I don't think your father needs spark right now. It's you.
Sorry, I went French on you.
Yeah, well, I won't tell Bob Woodward if you don't. Now what? Why'd you text me? I was in the middle of everything.
Well, I texted you, first of all, because I can. because no matter what else happens, I will go down in history as the first president with a smartphone.
Okay, good. We'll make sure Mount Rushmore has one behind your ear. And then second?
Second, because I went out this week, did my town hall meeting, I did my speeches. I think I kind of had the spark. Michelle, to the contrary, notwithstanding. And yet, we haven't moved the needle at all. I mean, Fox News has me at 37%.
Sir, what have we agreed on every time this comes up?
I forget. That's the kind of mood I...
If San Francisco has a frickin' earthquake that's a 10 on the Richter scale, it's not going to move the needle on Fox News.
Richter doesn't go above 8.
You know, I can make a call. You can be on Jeopardy within an hour. Look, honestly, I'm juggling a whole different set of balls right now.
Right?
I'm focusing on stuffing Jesse Jackson Jr.'s cojones in his mouth and making him think it's goose liver pate. But you want literally my 2 cents on this?
I mean, I thought I was fired up this week. I just didn't feel ready to go, I guess.
Okay. You've got a freaking cabinet with all the TV appeal of roadkill. You've got no surrogates worth squat. It's all on you. And, sir, Rahm Emanuel for you, sir. You're still a great salesman. You're just burdened with pushing a crap bag product. You heard that woman at the town hall. She still likes you. She just doesn't like what you're selling.
What? By administration? Democratic Congress?
Patience. Frickin' patience.
Hey, I'm still the president. I'm entitled to an answer right here.
You're selling patience to a freaking country that doesn't do anything like patience. You'd do better pitching Botox to a effing baboon.
I don't know.
I do. The economists say the recession is over and the jobs are a lagging indicator. People without jobs don't feel like any kind of effing indicator. You're telling them to be patient. No. You got a freaking war that's going south because the Taliban are going north. You're telling the voters to be patient.
Although, in fairness, we're still sticking to the July 2011 deadline for starting the removal of, you know, something. Oh, speaking of which, give me a second. Darcy, please get me Bob Gates.
Look, Mr. O, this is no skin off the top of my anything, but patience sounds like something Jimmy Carter sold. What did Reagan push when the economy was in the freaking toilet? He was Mr. Sunshine and Optimism. He was the recovery. Or at least he played one on TV.
Hold on.
Mr. President, it's Bob Gates.
Hi, Bob. Rahm's here with me.
For the moment.
I know the feeling. Hi, Rahm. Yes, Mr. President, I left a budget meeting. What's...
I'll tell you what's up, Bob. Your people, from General Petraeus on down, are leaking all over the place that our December Afghanistan review is going to be a review in name only.
Well, I thought that was a pretty fair approximation to where we left it.
So did I, but exactly what's supposed to happen if, let's say, the President of the United States wants to change his mind and have a real review. You know, I'm being boxed in by your guys. It has to stop. Pronto-ish.
Ish.
Shush.
Mr. President, I'm trying to ram some budget discipline down this building's throat before I leave.
No, I know.
What you're asking for amounts to a pretty heavy lift, especially since a lot of your people seem to have leaked all over Bob Woodward how much they don't believe in a war or my guys are trying to fight for you.
Well, you've got a point.
And how you wrote your own 16-page policy for my guys because you didn't trust them not to expand the mission.
Yeah, well, see, I thought that made me look pretty damn engaged.
Oh, it did.
All right.
It did.
Do you guys need me to put it in writing that they better not leak or it's General McChrystal time for?
Yes.
Mr. President, I'm not a betting man.
No.
But the betting men in this building think Stanley McChrystal's the final general that you can afford to fire.
What is it? Sort of a 7-3 type odds?
Heavier.
Okay.
If I may, when December comes, and if you want to have a real review, just blame it on conditions on the ground. That's code for my guy screwed up. They'll get the message.
You think?
20-1.
Okay, Bob. Thanks.
See, this is why you're selling a bad effing product.
What are you talking about?
You think you can sell patience because you've got some. Either that or... you just got rolled over by a freaking outgoing member of your chicken scat cabinet.
I don't know, Brahm. Feels like everybody is quitting on me right around now, is barreling down the lane at me. Don't you think?
I don't know, sir. Ask Jesse freaking Jackson freaking Jr. You know, nice work correcting the quotes in your rug.
You'd think somebody around here could fact-check historic quotes.
Look, think about it. You don't have to be right.
No.
You just have to freaking sell freaking Sonny.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week on the show.
We're so sorry.
Netflix recently staged a flashy launch event for their expansion into Canada, the first international locale to gain access to Netflix streaming services. Netflix's audience at the event was enthusiastic. Yet, bizarrely, the company chose to hire scores of extras to roam around the press conference, talking up Netflix and pretending they weren't hired, and given an enthusiastic script to read. Journalists caught on, accused Netflix of sweetening the audience with planted actors, and the company confessed. Netflix officially apologized. Steve Swayze, vice president of communications, said, "I was unaware that script was handed out to extras, and that was not supposed to happen. Some people got carried away, and it's embarrassing to Netflix," unquote. What, the extras were supposed to ad-lib? Steve? Steve? Oh, he left. Dateline Hartford, Connecticut, a state marshal this week broke down crying as he apologized for a lap dance he took at a New Haven strip club while he was attempting to serve the owner with a tax warrant last spring. Two officers from the State Marshal Commission took testimony in the actions of Marshal William Nolan after finding probable cause that he unreasonably mixed and blurred his personal actions with his professional duties at Stage Door Johnny's on East Street in New Haven. I'll be there tonight. Two shows. I think it was a lack of judgment, and I want to put on the record that I apologize to my wife and family and my 87-year-old mother, who almost had a breakdown herself, Nolan told commissioners. That's not me. I've never been in that place before in my life, he told the commissioners. He was also charged with failing to act with due diligence when he charged Johnny Kraft, owner of Stage Door Johnny's, 10% more than he should have on his tax bill. This is a confused man. The city of New Westminster, British Columbia, has formally apologized to the Chinese-American community in its midst for historic discrimination after unearthing evidence of racist policies span a 66-year period in the city archives. Speaking with Mandarin translator Mayor Wayne Wright offered the apology during an emotional ceremony at City Hall this week, making the municipality the first in Canada to offer such an apology to the community. The city of New Westminster acknowledges, based on a review of city records covering the period from 1860 to 1926, that it acted in a discriminatory manner towards its Chinese community, said Wright. At this time, the city of New Westminster formally apologizes to the Chinese community for its past action. Jin Wong, an 87-year-old veteran of the Second World War, said the parents' generation deserved the apology, even if they were not around to hear it. Facebook, the runaway social networking success that many in the web hosting business consider a potentially dangerous competitor, suffered an outage of several hours this week after a change to a cache configuration value caused a database cluster to be overwhelmed. What? In a post made Thursday evening to the company's engineering blog, Facebook's director of software engineering, Robert Johnson, apologized for the outage, which lasted roughly 2.5 hours. The rest of this story is complete jargon. U.S. Representative Jesse Jackson Jr., Democrat of Illinois, said he is deeply sorry for having disappointed some supporters regarding his relationship with a female social acquaintance, but he vowed to stay in office in the wake of a Chicago Sun-Times report that a major political fundraiser has told federal authorities that Jackson directed him to offer former Governor Blagojevich millions of dollars in campaign cash in return for an appointment for Jackson to the U.S. Senate seat succeeding President Obama. So it's an apology and a no. I'm sorry I've disappointed some supporters, and for that I'm deeply sorry, but I remain committed to serving my constituents and fighting on their behalf, said Jackson. Dateline Santa Ana, California, Democratic Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez says her now famous remark about Vietnamese trying to take her seat had been misinterpreted, but apologized if it caused any offense. She did not apologize, however, for calling her Republican challenger Von Tran, himself an immigrant from Vietnam, anti-immigrant. Instead, she accused him of using her words to take a cheap political shot. It's all campaign rhetoric to me. Dateline South Bend, Indiana, the company behind a digital billboard in Indiana that was missing one key letter, the L, from public schools, apologized and said the error has been corrected. The Blue Waters Group, contracted by the city of South Bend to promote the city, took responsibility for the pubic schools typo on a digital billboard, inviting the people to visit South Bend www.dpinsidetheradio.com. I feel terrible. It's a mistake we made, and we're guilty of it and responsible for it, and we take full responsibility for the error, said Patrick Strickler, president of the Blue Waters Group. He said the ad was taken out of the digital billboard's rotation and corrected before being replaced. Attaboy. 2 days after her off-the-cuff comment that Fresno looks like Detroit, Republican gubernatorial candidate in California Meg Whitman apologized at a local fundraiser for the statement's wording, but not its message. She was speaking in an economic sense that metropolitan Detroit has a lower unemployment rate than Fresno County, which she added is not acceptable. At the Fresno fundraiser, Whitman admitted to a poor choice of words when she said, "It looks of Fresno, it looks like Detroit, it's awful." She said, "It didn't go over well." Among those who paid for the lunch of steak and asparagus, the apology seemed to be accepted. The Apologies of the Week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, news of the godly, as promised previously. And there's some familiar congregations involved in this particular section of News of the Godly. The Order of Nuns, co-founded by Mary MacKillop in Australia, agrees that MacKillop, Australia's first saint, was excommunicated by the Catholic Church. Why? Because she exposed a pedophile priest. I don't think they mean literally. A new documentary about MacKillop's life reports that she was punished in 1871 for reporting child abuse to the authorities. 1871. It's a new thing. Previous theories surrounding the excommunication have been vague, with the Catholic Church still describing it on its website as being for alleged insubordination. And the website of the Sisters of St. Joseph of the Sacred Heart, the order MacKillop co-founded in 1866, describes the punishment simply as a misunderstanding, without giving details. But the documentary Compass says Bishop Lawrence Scheel ordered the punishment after MacKillop reported child abuse by Father Keating from the Kapunda Parish north of Adelaide. Le plus enchant. And the Catholic Church's Sex Abuse Commission in Australia, set up by then Melbourne Archbishop George Pell, has apologized and discreetly paid thousands of dollars to four victims of alleged pedophile priest Peter Chalk in the late 1990s. But the commission has declined to say if it alerted authorities to Chalk's whereabouts and status. Chalk, in fact, has been living in Japan since 1995 when he left his Catholic order in Australia after his alleged victims went to the police after years of inaction over the allegations. The Australian newspaper, owned by Rupert Murdoch, last week found the former priest, who had changed his name to Peter Shiraishi, living in Emerald Town, south of Tokyo, where he's been. Any guesses? Teaching at a local school is the correct answer, ladies and gentlemen. Teaching in a local school. If you guess teaching in a local school, you are the winner. There are no prizes, but teaching in a local school is the very correct answer. A spokesman for the Catholic Archdiocese of Melbourne said that when Cardinal Pell was the Archbishop, he had apologized to three of the victims who had also received compensation after their complaints were upheld by an independent commissioner. The apologies confirm the Church has known for more than a decade about Chalk's alleged abuse, but they did not answer the newspaper's question about whether it had alerted Japanese authorities to Chalk's activities. News of the Godly, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
your foxy fur. When you step out late at night, you're looking good. You know you're looking so good. You're looking good. Just like they told me that you would. Now look here, here. Mama, mama, get your mojo. And papa, get your gun.
Yes, this is still a show, and now, Tales of Airport Security. Read in a conversational tone to increase accessibility. Gary writes, Dear Harry, I work at the LAX airport as a TSO, which I guess means Transportation Safety Security Officer, where I'm one of the few officers who's been trained on the full body imager at my terminal. These machines take longer to operate per passenger, produce higher levels of radiation, and are much more expensive than traditional metal detectors. They are also, in my opinion, less secure than our normal screening methods, as there is a portion of the image around a person's groin that is censored, creating a security hole. Nevertheless, management is very keen to see these machines used as often as possible. Last Monday was particularly busy, and there were only three of us present who were trained on the imagers. The machines require four TSOs to be operated. At first, this seemed to be a net positive for the passengers, as it meant more personnel were available to operate our more efficient traditional screening process. However, this was not to be. Management was upset that the imagers were not being operated. When my immediate supervisors attempted to explain that we didn't have enough officers to run the machine safely, the managers didn't want to hear it. My supervisor gathered up the three of us and informed us of the situation. I suggested that we contact other terminals and see if there were any extra trained officers available. My supervisor had a different idea. The security queue was routed past the front of the imager, and the three of us were told to pretend to screen passengers, shuffling back and forth from the secure to the unsecure area. The proximity of the passengers would make it appear to management as though we were using the imager, when in fact we would send the passengers over to the metal detector. When I protested, they threatened to write me up. Thus, on one of the busiest days I can remember, the security queue got longer and longer as three of the most experienced TSOs pretended to work rather than actually processing passengers with our traditional methods. Tales of Airport Security, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And three guesses: who is one of the major salespeople, high-paid lobbyists pushing for the adoption of these full-body scanning imagers by the federal government? Former head of the Department of Homeland Security, Michael Chertoff. You're welcome.
Hello. Hello. Oh. Hello.
hello. Oh. Something's wrong. Something here that doesn't last too long. Maybe I shouldn't think of you as mine. But I can't help it, baby. Cause seeing you, yeah, seeing anyone as much as I do you, take for granted that you're always there. I take for granted that you just don't care. Sometimes I can't help seeing all the way through, baby. You know why? Oh, yeah. It's important to me.
Now, just briefly, it's clean, it's shape, it's sheep, it's safe, it's shape, it's safe. It's nuclear power, a series of unexplained mechanical failures, including a large hot water leak and the activation of a fire suppression system, triggered an emergency shutdown at Indian Point 3 nuclear plant in New York. Recently, it's the seventh unplanned shutdown between the twin Indian Point reactors in the past 2 years. It's just 20 miles from the New Jersey border in New York. Border. And nuclear power expansion fee that will show up on Georgia Power bills in January will be bigger than the utility indicated when lobbying for the fee. Georgia Power said the initial fee will add $3.73 to the typical monthly residential bill in 2011. Why, that's a tax increase. No, it's a fee. More than double the $1.30 the figure said the company and its supporters used when it convinced the state legislature to allow the fee. The fee will ratchet up to $9 over the following 4 years. rather than 6, as previously suggested. It's clean, it's safe, it's cheap, it's nuclear power. It's your friend the Atom. Hey, Addy. Oh, he split. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ. Around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. On the Mighty 104 in Berlin, available for your smartphone from stitcher.com. And available as a free podcast from kcrw.com. And it'd be just like if I could talk to you more conversationally and with less elitism in my voice, if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. Uh-huh. Show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago in exile, and Hawaii desks. I actually was face-to-face with the San Diego desk this week. That's a thrill that I will not soon forget. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead and to Jenny Lawson here at WWNO-FM in New Orleans. The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. Teenage boys who want to volunteer to be mentored, just email me. There's some jewelry in it for you. And a man hug.